Hey everybody, what is going on? I hope everyone is doing well, and welcome back once again to a brand new episode of Sweeten Up Podcast, season number 2, episode number 86. I am your host, Jeff Spencer. Thank you so much for taking some time to join me today. I greatly appreciate it, whether you have for an entire season, an entire year, or you are today for the first time. Thank you so much for joining us. However, if you are just joining us for the first time, take a look back at our library of 85 episodes anytime you want, anywhere you listen to your podcasts. As always, if you like what you hear on the podcast today and you want to hear more, please be sure to tell all your friends and subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts so that you never miss a future episode. The podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for Sweeten Up Podcast. With that being said, my guest on the podcast today is the great and powerful John Watson. John Watson is head brewer and owner of Watson Farmhouse Brewery, located in Southbury, Connecticut, and is also the head brewer at New Salem Brewing Company on the Fairfield Hills campus in Newtown, Connecticut. John started brewing beer as a hobby after his wife Tracy gifted him a home brewing kit more than 25 years ago. He quickly became frequent with the home brewing competition circuit, meddling in the National Homebrew Competition with his recipes. In 2000, he was named New England Homebrewer of the Year, and in 2004, earned Best of Show at the Masters Championship of Amateur Brewing. He has collaborated with a host of local commercial brewers, from Willimantic Brewing, Captain Lawrence Brewing Company in Pleasantville, New York, and more. Along the way, he helped build commercial breweries for others, including Voracious Brewing Company in Monroe, Tribus Beer Company in Milford, and Beer Naked in Wilmington, Vermont. John and I had an amazing conversation live inside of his brewery in Southbury, Connecticut. Our conversation lasted for almost 2 hours, and you already know we covered everything I just mentioned and so much more. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here he is, my friend, and part one of my two-part conversation with one of the best brewers around, John Watson. Joining me on the podcast today, I am super, super excited because I am here at Watson Farmhouse Brewery in Southbury, Connecticut, and I'm sitting right across from a good friend of mine, the man, the myth, the legend. He doesn't really need an introduction, but he's the head brewer at New Salem Brewing Company, located at Fairfield Hills campus in Newtown, Connecticut, and he's the founder and brewer, of course, Watson Farmhouse Ales, the great and powerful John Watson. And John, it's so good to see you. This is great. I'm so glad we could be here inside your dojo, getting to have a nice conversation. And how
this
are you, man?
That's where it all happens. This is a magic shop here.
Yeah. How's it going, buddy?
It's good, man. So you said Watson Farmhouse Ales. We actually do lagers as well. So we are a brewery, not just about ales.
Amazing lagers.
But we love ales. Lagers, we sometimes love even more, you know? Like, as you know.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Absolutely, you know, yeah. I love your Pilsners. Yeah. I love all your beers, but you make some of the best Pilsners, which we were talking about before. And I can't wait to dive into all of it with you because it's going to be a great conversation. And but one place I want to start, like I do with most of my guests, is, you know, with the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, you know, on a personal level and a business level, you know, how did you manage to get by? I'm sure, you know, being a brewer, you were doing your thing at New Salem because they opened around that time.
We were actually just before that. So we had been like, just to give you a brief background on what we did, like we being, you know, if we want to deep dive way back, you know, instead of going to high school, I went to a technical high school, which I got a mechanical background, which kind of set me up for starting a plumbing and heating company, which I did right away when I was young. So by like 1998, I had my own company doing plumbing, heating, all mechanical work. And before that company started, I actually was home brewing. So both things were, you know, kind of worked together. So
yeah,
there was that.
Yeah.
But we actually started stockpiling brewing equipment, like, because we knew the trades, which right now my knees are not great. In both knees, I blew out one 2009. The other knee is like starting to feel the weights of like compensating for the other one. But we started stockpiling brewing equipment, which we were buying, you know, around the country through like a site called Pro Brewer, which people were selling used equipment and new equipment. So our dream, or not really our dream, but our focus on retirement was to start a brewery from around 2011. And by 2012, we had bought a brew house. By like 2013, we had fermentation. And we were just looking for somewhere to put it that made sense. And it just never, we never found a spot that really made sense.
Right.
You know, like that was, you know, wasn't going to bleed us dry before we even built it. Like, so we kept looking. We tried to partner with some people. And both things fell through. And we just held on to our, you know, I just kept plumbing, heating, and around 2017, we were told, yeah, our town business planner was like, yeah, I think that's a great idea if you want to build a brewery on your property. So we're like, totally, that's our focus now to keep the overhead low. We wanted to build, you know, something ground up, which I built all myself and designed everything, and we just took our equipment that was in storage, kind of set it up into the way we wanted it, and we set it up to grow so we can like fit more tanks and everything's kind of plug and play. So as we build it, we can add and hey, there's our famous glycol chiller kicking in right now.
That's awesome. Yeah, there's going to be different sounds going on throughout
this. Just to let you know.
Yeah.
But we kind of built it, in the way that it could be a small, really tight brewery on our property. We're in the farm hills of Southbury here, which is kind of the old Manville house, which is a really prominent name in Southbury. He's actually, our first selectman. And, there's many Manvilles in this area. So
yes.
It's very old, rustic farmland, rolling hills,
yeah,
which we love. You know, it's like we wanted to build something that looked like we were in Vermont. Without being in Vermont,
yeah,
and still staying close to our kids and families, and which was the only really thing that kept us here, because we were ready to move and just go do this somewhere else. Because all the obstacles that that were in front of us, and definitely once our town planner said, "Yeah, I think that's a great idea." Kent Falls had just built a farm brewery, so it was already an example of this model in Connecticut. And we used kind of like some of their, track record stuff as they were building it, like their models and like, through all, like local, being local, off the grid, making beer, how to make it work. We can do this. You know, we can bring grain in, get it out, take all our waste, and get it out without, doing anything negative to our community.
Yeah.
And not making a lot of noise. And, we have a working cow farm right across the street, which you can hear cows. And we don't really impact it in any way to negatively affect our neighbors. So we've been pretty good about what we do. We're not looking to build a big industrial giant, situation here that's going to cause a ruckus. We just kind of make, in the grand scheme of things, we make about less than 200 barrels of beer a year here. So in the grand scheme of things, that's not a lot of beer.
Gotcha.
It's really a freckle on a flea's ass is what I say in the brewing industry. So we try to focus on using Connecticut-grown grains and everything we do except for our lagers. Our lagers are very important to country-specific, grains. In our Italian Pilsner, we use 100% Italian grains. German, 100% German grains. We make a Saaz lager, 100% Moravian-grown malt from Czech Republic. But all our ales will get Thrall family malt grown right here in Connecticut.
Yeah,
Windsor Locks.
Yeah, so great.
They're really growing some nice grains, flake wheat,
they do.
Oats, spelt. We use beautiful flake spelt in our Hoppy Blonde, which we like to keep. As like it's really our only beer that's European inspired, I would call it. Like not really a Saison, but
and what's it called?
Spelt driven. It's called Eyes of Lust.
Right.
And we make that. It's 4.5%. We use flake spelt from Thrall Family Malt. We like to use a little bit of American hops, but we do use European hops in it to give it that floweriness, that character like lagers have, but it's really an ale. So the ale yeast uses a little fruitiness. But it's really smooth and drinkable because we keep the ABV low in it. And it's kind of like our boat beach summer crusher.
Yeah.
Other than our lagers. I mean, our lagers are like, they're a little, our lagers are like 0.3% more alcohol, yeah. but like warrant even more crushability because they're just so clean and crisp.
You definitely make some fizzy of the yellow, you know? Some of the cleanest, cleanest, crisp, yeah. Crispest, yeah. Crispiest. I guess yeah. I should say, beers yeah. That are super crushable yeah, for sure.
We like to keep it extra crispy, you know?
I love it. I love it. And, you know, yeah. you're no joke, though. I mean, yeah. you've won homebrewing competitions. You were
yeah, I got, New like, if you look up there, we got, like, baskets, boxes yeah. full of ribbons, medals.
Yeah, you're, yeah. yeah.
We got the hardware to back it up.
Yeah.
So we're not, like, you know, most breweries now, like, are marketing companies that want to contract brew and just flood the markets with all these ideas that are just basically marketing, like I'm building a Lego and selling it to the public. I've put the time in, man. I've been like in the trenches yeah. winning awards for
I know
since like I don't know, like my first I won the first competition I ever entered. I won the national homebrew competition,
yeah,
bronze medal for Oktoberfest,
yeah,
like, and I was just like, whoa, man, how did I do that? That kind of makes me want to brew more beer. And then after that, I just kept brewing and entering. It kind of got me hooked into competitions. And then I met some local people here in Connecticut, the Underground Brewers of Connecticut. We just, you know, they showed me the competition circuit. By the year 2000, I'd become New England Home Brewer of the Year.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yep. Also brewed my first commercial batch of beer in 1999 with Hammer Nails. So I did their oatmeal stout for them. Which was kind of like surreal because I entered this. They were like, yeah, we want a Connecticut brewer to brew our stout. And I'm like, all right. So I entered two stouts and out of like 40 breweries or brewers, I came in first and second. They chose my oatmeal stout first and my dry stout second. So
that's awesome.
We brewed with Peter Hammer, which is great, when that brewery was in Watertown, where it finally went down in like 2001, right after the World Trade Towers kind of dropped. There yeah. was like a people forgot to drink beer and support their local craft brewery, like
yeah.
because they were everybody was in a coma
right
from that
right
thing happening.
Yeah,
and I think their landlord kind of found some missing water and they blamed it on the brewery. I don't know if they had a water leak out in the driveway or something, but that brewery went down pretty fast and it was sad because it was my first like stab at, you know, like getting my beer into the hands of people.
Yeah. Why did you start brewing?
Why did I start brewing? It's kind of plain and simple. Like, really, like, I grew up where my parents were never around. They just worked.
Where'd you grow up, by the way?
I grew up in Ridgefield. You know, I started in Weston, Connecticut. And, you know, I lived with my grandparents for a few years. Mother was divorced and then got remarried. And we moved to Ridgefield. And when I was in Ridgefield, you know, we lived in rented houses. Finally, we bought a house as a family. And my parents always worked. They were very hardworking people. Mom was a radar engineer through, like, Northrop Grumman and,
wow.
you know, Westinghouse and all these different
wow.
the company kept getting bought out. But it was Norden Systems in Norwalk.
Sure.
And she put the time in. She was overseas a lot. She was everywhere, radar engineer. And then my stepfather was an architect who worked late hours in like New Canaan, Greenwich area. And so if I wanted to eat food that tasted good, I had to make it myself. So I grew up like cooking for myself. Like,
gotcha.
So when we go to the grocery store, I had to make, if I wanted to eat food, I had to make it myself. And if I wanted, you know, like I started out with like the macaroni and cheese and then like throwing stuff into it to make it taste better. And then from there, it kind of like got crazy. I made all my own food, like, you know, except for like, you know, they just give me the school lunch program, which sucked, but like but so as a young adult I really enjoyed cooking food a lot, and so like beer was no different. And
sure.
I always kind of like in school I think science was my favorite subject too, so that didn't hurt, right? Like
no.
so science was, you know, brewing is basically science. I mean, it's like time, temperature, you know.
You're a chemist.
So, yeah. Well, you don't really have to be a chemist, but it helps. You know, like attention to detail, fundamental repetitiveness or whatever you want to call it, like
sure.
Where you know your objectives, and you know, so you can really, when you're making a new beer, that's where it all counts, when you want to be the chemist. But if you're making something that you've already made 1,000 times, all right, you know, like, you're just doing it again. Like, yeah, you don't have to get crazy.
True.
But you do want to check all the things that, you know, go along with making good beer, you know, times, temperatures, gravities, you know, all the things that beer is made of, bitterness levels and just carb levels, and, you know, seeing it through as a child from start to finish. Like, you're, you know, it's like cooking food, you know, it takes 1 hour or sometimes 4 hours. Making a really great beer takes sometimes 2 months. So it's, you know, it's, when you're thinking of lager. So that's where it really comes into, like, the attention to detail. And there's certain things that have to happen along the way that just, you can't just set it and forget it. You have to think about it. We do diacetyl rest with lagers that have to happen at a certain time. So we get that buttery popcorn flavor in our beer. We set temperatures to get yeast out enough to not drop temperatures enough so that when we, so we take a beer from, like, let's say 70 degrees and we want to drop down to 63, just to get enough yeast out of it. So when we dry hop it, our temperatures at the right temperature for dry hopping, we get the most out of our dry hops.
Right.
Rather than crashing a beer past where it's, where it needs to go for the optimal temperature for hops. So, I mean, there's, you know, and, like, it's just, there's a lot of things going on with all our different beers, and I got that times too, because I'm, like, here and at Newsheim. So I don't even know how I manage it. If you ask me, I don't know. I do it. I don't even think about it. I just do it. Like,
yeah,
when you think about when you're, like, I can think about my trade years when I worked in plumbing and heating, and I got to say, once I showed up for a job to install something or plumb a house or install a boiler, when you're into it, your mind is so into it, you're really not even focusing on thinking. You're just doing what you know you have to do. And that's kind of where I'm at in my brewing. I just don't, I know what I'm doing, how it has to be done, the time, everything involved. Like, if you take the Solera, everything going on, I don't really try and focus on one little thing, because it'll get the Solera of all the thinking, like, bottled up. You know what I mean? Like, so it just, you know, it is a big task to, like, brew at a brewery, and then it's like, and then you got two, like, and I didn't want that, like, in the beginning, but, like, you know, I had friends, you know, that were building a brewery, and they were like, hey, man, like, you're the guy. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm the guy? I already had built a brewery. I got my own. Like, why do I need that? Like,
yeah.
So, but in a way, the focus on not, you know, because if you thought about, like, running all these things at once, like,
yeah,
you kind of get anxiety, right? Like, or
oh, yeah,
you would feel, like, uneasy.
I always wondered how you, like, did it.
Well, I mean, it's I don't know, even know how I do it. Like, I don't think about, like, everything.
Just don't think about it.
So I try not to think about everything at once, so it doesn't give you anxiety.
Let the good times roll.
Yeah, like, just, like, know what you have to do, do what you have to do.
That's it.
And get to the next thing. You
That's
know?
Awesome. Like, you should put that on a T-shirt.
But yeah, right. But if you really think about the whole scheme of, like, running a brew pub and a production brewery at the same time, I mean, the only way I really am able to do it, I have a really great co-brewer, Dave Lenari at Newsheim, who's got my back always. Mm. And then you got, like, you know, Mark Tombasio, who kind of, like, you know, he's kind of, like, does the ordering there, you know. Like, I couldn't, like, do everything at both breweries, you know, like, and
another
and
then, legend, yeah, the Tombasio then, family,
yeah, yeah, Tombasio, My Place Restaurant, yeah, you know, the crew there, Sharky, yeah.
Mark, Dave, and
then,
John,
yeah, and then
the legends, know, who make it happen, yeah, at New Silent Brewing.
We're really kind of grinding it out there, and it comes in waves, and, you know, this time of year it's a little more laid back, and but, you know, about a month from now we'll be brewing so much stuff we don't know, you know, we're running in circles,
yeah,
but
speaking of Newsheim, yep, when did they reach out? You know, when was it that it came together that they reached out to you and were like, hey, do you want to join up and do this with us?
Well, I mean, they kind of had that idea the whole time while I was building my brewery. Like,
gotcha.
But so,
and when did Watson Farmhouse?
In the grand scheme of things, like, in the pandemic, like, which was, like, what, 2019.
Yeah.
Was just starting to come. Well, it wasn't even a thing yet. It, you know, it was, like, overseas at this time.
Right.
our brewery had just hit stride. We did like this, we called it the foam raiser here. So we had just,
a foam raiser.
We had friends and family. It. We had everybody. We had all the rock stars here, man. We had like Greg Radovich, New England. We had Matt Westfall from Counterweight. We had this big party here, man.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I homebrewed a bunch of beer. And we just like, because literally when we had this building built,
yeah,
we had no money left to buy grain or hops or yeast or anything. This thing was just sitting here ready to go.
I mean, this is impressive.
In our bank accounts, and we had rabbit ears for pockets and empty bank accounts. And a good friend of mine, Dan Holmes, who runs like this Holmes Fine Gardens.
Really, I work for Holmes Fine Gardens.
Really cool.
Like, I'm one of his employees.
Yeah, really cool landscape guy.
That's my boss.
Newtown, who's just such a great guy.
That's
man.
My boss. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah? Holmes Fine Gardens?
I work for him during the summer.
He's fucking greatest guy ever, dude.
I know.
He and his friends, which I got Chef Jay Daly to cater it. Like, we had some like good people here, man. And we got together. And we just did this like big party here, like, and we couldn't park people here, so you know what we did? We had a shuttle. We had three people shuttling people from the church down the hill.
That's awesome.
It has a huge parking lot.
Yeah.
To my brewery here.
That's awesome.
And we weren't open as a brewery, so we really couldn't get in trouble at this point in time. Our license, we didn't have our license yet, but our license was like any day. So we just like had this big party here. We had Dan Carlucci and Dave Kay, you know, like Nod Hill, you know.
Oh, wow.
Like,
that's awesome.
Hitch and Giddy Up guys here. Like playing acoustic music in the corner.
Dave came on the show recently.
Yeah, it's just like a big, nice party here.
That's
like,
awesome.
And it really raised enough money to call up BSG and go, hey, man, I need a pallet of grain.
Nice.
Called up my yeast supplier. I need some yeast.
Nice.
And then I got some hops and like, and we really literally got this brewery going after we spent all the money we had with these first batches of beer that just kind of rolled into like making money. But as soon as our second batch was ready to go down, COVID hits, right?
Yeah.
All our beers and kegs.
Wow.
The bars are shut down.
Yeah.
And this is like where you're getting at, right? Like where it all like kind of went down to like where we were like wondering, what are we going to do with this beer? It's stuck in kegs. It's stuck in restaurants. Our kegs, we can't even get them back because they're half full at all these bars. So we immediately took all the kegs we had and brought them over to New Salem and just started growling, you know, running growlers off the loading dock. And they weren't even selling beer yet.
I remember.
They
didn't
even have beer because they our first batch of beer there was like April.
Yeah.
April 1st, April Fool's
Day. So that's how that came together. Because I was there. I was there
so
on loading dock.
We were loading dock jamming, like growlers.
That's where I met you.
Yeah. And then finally, we had a bunch of the next batch of beer that we made. We rolled it all into kegs. And the good boys from Reverie had rented a can line through Anvil, who's actually our canner now, who's the greatest guy ever. I love Todd.
Awesome.
Anvil. He had rented Reverie, a can, like a two-head, just small canning line that we actually kegged. We canned off our kegs and rat-dogged some labels and just started canning. And that's what really got us into canning. And then from there on out, we're like, through this whole pandemic, we can't put any beer into kegs right now. 100% of it has to just go into cans. And so we switched our focus let's say we brewed our first batch was released in the wild in February, and our next batches were released in the wild. You know, we growlered it. That was the next like phase, and then we just like and the community was great. We went to Counterweight; they gave us growlers. Reverie gave us growlers. Nod Hill gave us growlers. We couldn't even get growlers at the time because everybody was buying growlers, and the pinch was on. So we reached out to these guys that were already canning and that didn't rely on the growlers, but they still needed the growlers because they had a beer. They had a lot of beer stuck in kegs too.
Right.
And they had to, you know, the only way to get a beer out of a keg immediately to the customer is to growler it or crowler it or, you know, get it into some way the public can take it away from your brewery with their masks and hand sanitizers and protocols from the health department.
Toilet
and
paper.
Everything else going on. Like it was crazy time.
Yep.
But, we, you know, and then we got, you know, New Salem off the ground where, you know, it was right into kind of like COVID tap room protocol. Yeah. Where it was all kind of like plexiglass, everything.
And yep.
Just everybody was like stuck behind glass, little
yeah. cubicle. Compartmentalize
like,
everyone.
Yeah. Compartmentalize. Yeah. But like, you know, those times were like, it was so bad. Like for like to deliver the most social drink there is, beer, to people that have to be so isolated, like, and can't talk to each other because of this pandemic was brutal. Nuts. I mean, it was like really,
yeah, really, absolutely
really
brutal.
The bad time. But like, what it did for us though is COVID. It really slowed our start. So like, we didn't jump into this thing racing and going and having to figure like all this stuff out quick. You know, even though I've been around brewing for a while, I've never ran a brewery and talked to the state,
yeah.
talked to the feds. Yeah. You know, hey, yeah, we'll get your label done in a couple months for you so you can release that. No, I got the beer now. I would need it. You know, so the learning curve on a lot of things was easier to handle because of the time frame of the easiness of, you know, everything was moving slower. You know, if we jumped right into it at a fast-paced environment, it probably would have been way more crazy. Your anxiety would have been through the roof.
Sure. You know?
But so, again, COVID really got us into, like, canning right out of the gate, which really was a great thing for us because we have one of the best label artists in Connecticut, Emily Barnes, my best man at my wedding's daughter, who really stepped up and
incredible. I was going
to
ask.
And she asked me, you know, like, she came up to me, Uncle Johnny, can I, like, do your, you know, can labels? And I'm like, I don't think that there's anybody else that I want to do them than you. I've seen your art. I've seen your mom's art, like, family artists, like, and everything I've ever told her to do for me has been great. So, like, we already have this person that could help us, like, put a face or art label on our cans and kind of bring a brewery forward and get it into the marketplace, and it looks very professional. I mean, like, everything she's ever done for me has been top-notch, 100% all in.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Your labels are insane.
Yeah.
Because when you see your beer compared to others on the shelves, it looks way more appealing to pick up and drink.
Yeah, and it's not...
Not only because you're brewing it, and it's incredible, yeah. but because the art, I mean, you look at it and you're like, that's... Because some people save and collect cans,
yeah.
and all of yours are... very collectible.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot behind what we do with our art and stuff. But
so shout out to
Emily.
Emily's really
going. And then one of my neighbors owns a distillery who you may want to talk to eventually. I don't know if you know Phil Simpson, who owns Asbury Park Distillery.
No,
he's right over here.
How about that?
Good friend of the family here, and he's a graphic artist, so he takes her art and builds all my labels, pops the barcode on it, and
teamwork.
He gets it all together, and
that's
you
awesome.
Know, puts the ABV on it, and makes it all, and he's really clever with his, like, conceptual ideas of the way the typeface should be, the way the color should be, so there's a lot of detail behind that I couldn't even think about that. I mean, he's like, he sends it, and I'm like, that's bomb, dude. Like, every time. Like,
so, I brew the beer,
so the
damn
crew
it.
Behind, like, getting these cans out there is, like, really solid. And then
that's
the
awesome.
Other part of the crew that gets these cans out there is just me and the wife. I mean, we're self-distro. We're pounding the streets. We don't use any distributorship. We don't go too far away, but, like, we try and, you know, we hit some really good spots. I mean, Ancona's is great to us. Carluzzi's, only grocery store I want to work with because I know they keep everything cold. We do Bantam Market, too. It's another great grocery store with a beer cave. Everything's kept cold, never warm. They treat our beers very well.
It's true. I didn't think
so
about that.
So we don't want warm stacks on the floor of the big Y. Or, you
right.
know, I'm not trying to drop names, but we don't want grocery store
Stop and shop.
Warm stacks or we don't want the big corporate liquor stores with warm stacks. We're never going to shop our beer out to be commercially brewed off-site, like contract brewed, just so we could throw warm stacks on every big box store or Costco. We're not. That's nothing that we don't care about money. I mean, we obviously we want to make this thing work, but we're not looking to get rich. We're just looking to do what we do. I mean, I've been making beer for almost 30 years. It's what I like to do. It's what we do. The product has to be treated well. It's like, why flood the market just to do that because you want money? Like, I want money, but I don't need it that bad where I want my beer cooking on a warm floor and someone grabs it and doesn't like it. Like, and now they think bad of me because I made this beer that didn't taste well, and they don't even understand that it was on a warm floor and that's what made it bad. They just think I made bad beer. I don't want, you know, that in my life.
It's funny because I have noticed that when I see your beers, it's always cold.
It's always cold.
It's always in a fridge. Cold.
That's, we pride ourselves on making beer, respecting where its state of where it needs to be at any given time, and we will never sell a bad beer. You know what I mean?
Like, you and your wife hustle and do such a great job because honestly,
I couldn't do it without her.
I have a hard time not finding your beer.
She's the workhorse behind the force here.
Like, your beer is everywhere. Yeah. I have a hard time not finding it.
Yeah, well, we're kind of vocal to the fact that we know the right people because we've been around the industry for so long that we move it to, like, we move it as far as like Micro, and we, you know, Eli Cannon's in Middletown, they picked us up.
Legendary
place.
Which
is like OG. You know, legendary my place is also OG. You know,
oh, of course.
Like, when you think about it.
They're always up there, the best beer bars in Connecticut.
We're not looking to really get out of the state at this point because we want to, you know, once you use a distributor, they're stepping on it where you have to really we're not a production brewery. So we are in effect, I mean, you could pigeonhole us as a production brewery, but we're so small that we can't sell a $50 case of beer wholesale. We just can't do that. Like, it just, our costs are too much to do that. So, I mean, if we want to sit here and break even and not make any money, we could use a distributor that's going to make all the money. You know, they're making the margin, not us now.
Yeah.
So we deliver all our beer. Of course, kegging's a little easier because the packaging, you know, we just got hit with like a 25% markup on canning in a month. From buying cans 1 month to the next month, our cans, lids, and packaging materials went up 25%.
Was this supply chain stuff?
It's the whole aluminum game. And we're actually, you know, we're getting cans, we're trying whatever, and then you're getting these import cans from China, and they're still more money than the American one. You're like, so we're trying to figure it out, and everybody's dealing with it. And the fact that we, you know, we had to put like a little bit of markup onto our beer just to stay the same, not even to make more money, just to stay where we were. You know, 2 months ago is where we're at right now. So there is a little increase in our pricing, but it doesn't reflect us making any more money. It's just to keep, you know, the whole ball rolling. Without that, like, you know, we really couldn't, who wants to lose money to canned beer? Like, nobody, right? Like, so you have to kind of trickle that down a little bit. But, you know, talking to the liquor store owners, they're like, oh, yeah, it's not just you, Bo. It's like everybody, right? You know, every can in this store has gone up in the last 3 months. And I'm like, yeah, well, we just got hit now, so that's why our last canning run went. And it's not a lot. Like, you know, we're talking, you know, 50 cents on a four-pack, you know, wholesale. Like, it kind of went up. But we can't control that unless we had a big warehouse somewhere that, we can, but when you think about it, if you had to build a big warehouse somewhere and stock everything into it, like, what's it cost to build a warehouse and throw all that stuff into it and then move it here? Like,
true,
you know. So I mean, you just kind of ride the increase and until you're, you know, we never want to build this big industrial animal. So, you know, like Treehouse built, you know, probably a $5 million building to hold their cans. You know, like we're not doing that. You know, We're small. We're mom and pop here making beer. And we're hitting these, you know, we're just trying to duck under the shipping. Shipping's been killing us a little bit, too, with price of raw materials. We've been getting a little bit hit on that, which, you know, it's uncontrollable. But, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, we don't really increase our prices because of that because it's pretty minimal. But the can thing was huge for us when it went up.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite places to get beer when I lived in Newtown, I live in Danbury now. I'm actually moving to Brookfield pretty soon, like I said to you earlier. But one of the places I loved to get beer when I was in Newtown was Yankee Wine and Spirits, Chris Siskey, who was one of the
great to us, man.
Early episodes. Stuff.
It gives us like primetime shelf space. Like
yes, he does.
Face eye
it's,
level.
It's the first. It's literally the second door.
You walk right in, bam. There's
it's the second door on the right. I know that because
it's all the beer I make.
Like, exactly.
I've walked in there. I've been like, there's 15 different flavors I make between the two breweries. Yeah. Right there, right now. Like,
I know.
It's incredible.
It's basically, it's basically a door that's dedicated to John Watson.
Yeah, yeah
it's basically like a John Watson Hall of Fame door. So when you open it up and you grab a beer.
It kind of blows my mind a little bit when I see that. When I saw that, like I was like, one, two, three, four. Like, I
you got to take a picture.
Like, it just kept going, yeah. I think I did take a picture.
Yeah, did you? Yeah.
It's pretty
impressive
to think that one store holds that much liquid that I've made in a short period of time.
You just have to yell out to the customers there, I did this.
No, we've done in-store there.
I did
We do in-store there.
Like, yeah, they do great.
We popped up
there.
And, like, poured some people beer and just love it. And really, because we don't have a tap room or, you know, a face on-site sales here, really it's the only way we get to talk to our people we know. Like, because, like, you know, we do pop-up sales, of course. You know, we've done it at Nod Hill. We've done it at Nusam where we pop up to sell cans when we have them.
And you've done pop-ups at Harry's, another legendary liquor spot.
Well, yeah, we have never done pop-up sales there, but they sell our beer.
Okay,
yeah.
gotcha.
So my boy Renzo, man, he's the best guy.
Harry's is legendary.
Like really old
legendary
school. Like,
spot.
I love Renzo, man. We've done a lot of like Yankee Bruno's panel analysis and stuff over the years and really good in spirits and modern distillery age, modern brewery age, and Yankee Bruno's like totally... Renzo is like one of the OG guys for me. Love that he's like just so enthusiastic and excited about everything.
You know? Oh, yeah.
He's like really got a good head on his shoulders and loves music, which, you know, I think we all love music. You know, music drives our lives, really.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know about you, but...
Music's
like,
huge. Music's my family.
I mean, I grew up Grateful Dead. You know, I used to listen to like... You know, I grew up listening to the heavy metal a little bit, Black Sabbath, but I always had parents that played vinyl. So
me too.
Got into Grateful Dead, saw like 70 Dead shows, probably another 20 Jerry shows growing up. Like, so music was very important. And then when Jerry died, you know what? I got a little bit into like reggae music, a lot into it actually, and never really got away from that. Like really, just.
I played in a reggae band.
Yeah, just like bass, drum and bass, man.
As
like,
a drummer.
Took over my, you know, and funk too, man. Like funk is
important. Funk is amazing.
So we're like toots and maytals. So funk can drive reggae or like, you know, like, you know, there's, you know, drum and bass can go other ways. You know, you can have the lover boy stuff and all the different dance hall styles of reggae, but roots, rock, reggae, man. Like that's it for me. Like that's, and it could be about Jah, it could be American driven reggae artists who sing less about Ja, more about love and ganja.
Yeah.
But I have a good amount of friends around this area that I've inspired and they've inspired me with bands and throughout the years, like one of our favorite artists is Clinton Farron, who is original Gladiator bass player from Jamaica, which just really is in touch with lyrics, music, and he's like a professor of reggae.
Yeah.
To me, we have friends in Rochester, New York as well that play American roots reggae called Giant Panda Gorilla Dub Squad. That's
like
their actual name.
I like the name.
From Rochester, New York. We met them in about 2005 or 2006. They've been to this property, drank beer a lot with us, and if you look on our labels, all our IPAs have a panda.
I noticed
on that, and that's inspired by those guys.
That's
our
so
good
cool.
friends, Giant Panda Gorilla Dub Squad.
Nice who, it up has yeah. the panda surfing through yeah. the hops.
Yeah, it's an entire wave made out of hops.
Tremendous.
Surfing, and then our cool ruler, you know, our Keep It Nice is a panda playing ukulele on a desert island with two palm trees. With if you look at the palm trees, the palms are actually marijuana leaves upside down.
And then roller skates.
You know, like
the
feds
panda.
Pass that through the label, which was, we got it. You know, we did it.
Yeah.
We love it.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned vinyl. I really, really wish I still had my old podcast studio. Yeah. So when the podcast first started, I actually had a legit studio in the basement of my old home that I used to live in. And there was a wall that my dad had of anywhere between 5 to 10,000 records.
Wow.
And I have pictures of it, but you would have loved it. It was a great space, absolutely tremendous. Great, great memories and guests in that space. But yeah, music big in my house. My dad played guitar. You know, he's played guitar his entire life, you know, many decades. Bluegrass was the big thing that my dad really enjoyed. I would wake up many mornings as a young kid and listen to bluegrass. And then, of course, my dad, you know, he was getting me into the different radio stations like WBK, you know, WPKN and WFUV and all that. And so, yeah, music was always radiating throughout my house. On Sunday, there was an Irish program on WFUV called Killing Nigel, and there would just be Irish music blasting all day because there's some Irish in our family. And yeah, music's big. I'm actually going to see Marty Stewart at the Wall Street Theater in Norwalk.
Oh, sweet, man. Soon. I've not been to that theater yet.
Down there. Yeah, and Marty Stewart was just inaugurating the Country Music Hall of Fame. And he's not really the country you think when you think country. He's got like a bluegrassiness to it, and they're incredible. His group,
not singing about his dog that ran away and his wife that just shot him in the leg.
Or a tractor or drinking beer or Bush Light, nothing like that. We're not talking about Bush Light, nothing like that. Or working on the farm. He's got a great band called Marty Stewart and his Fabulous Superlatives, and they're incredible, absolutely incredible. Every single
Being a Watson, I always think of Doc Watson. It's like, fucking great assault.
Like tremendous.
Country
tremendous.
Singer, kind of like player, like ripping that that acoustic guitar, you know? Like,
exactly. Exactly. But no, bluegrass was big and just music in general. My mom, she would sing in the choir at church and played piano. Yeah. My sister played clarinet, and she can sing, and I played drums, and I played the saxophone too.
Oh, nice!
So,
yeah,
we were very musical. So,
yeah, I mean, my kids. Yeah, I was always. People ask me, "You play music?" I'm like, "Yeah, I play the brew pots, man."
That's awesome.
I got a 15 gallon brew pot system in my basement. I play it all the time, man.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh! And then, so getting back to Watson, I mean. One of the first places I actually had it on tap was Good Old Days. And it seems like a lot of your beers end up there.
Those guys
awesome.
Are great to me. You know, Matt Stanzak.
Legend.
Back from like Stanziato's. And, you know, he was a key player for like craft beer in Danbury. Like really down there until he sold out. And then I think he was suppressed a little bit because he had no compete clause, right? Like, so he couldn't get right back on the streets.
Yep.
So he laid down for a while.
Yep.
Like a snake in the grass,
chilled.
Man.
Yep, he was waiting.
And then he just fucking popped out of that grass, man. Ended up in Newtown. Shooting out of the gate with like these ridiculous
he'd end up in Newtown.
Detroit square pizzas, like, which is, they're like crack cocaine, man. You can't even like it's too much food to eat, but you eat it anyway. You don't care because it's so delicious.
Yeah.
The salads and like, and then Shaner bringing on the beer and the cocktails. Like, that's a... It's a great little dungeonous little dark cave to like just go enjoy yourself and get away from things, you know?
Like, it's like they always say there, it's about the details. Yeah. That's what they always say. It's about the details and they get the details right.
Yeah. And Matt was like a lot about the lager. So like, he had,
I mean, it goes great with pizza.
We when we got our Beata going, we're like, you know, like my whole idea was like, all right, I think I want to make, I don't want to give you a German Pilsner. You're Italian. You know what I mean? Like, you want... Or he's not... I don't know if he's not really Italian.
Let's pretend he is.
Yeah. He makes Italian food.
Yeah.
You know? But he's from that region. So he's in there. So we thought about, like, how do we bring a beer to him and collaborate? Like, it's hard to collaborate with a restaurant, right? Like, really is. Like, it's hard to collaborate with anybody other than a brewer, right? Like, you know, to really put... input into it, but we love that he made delicious food. We wanted a beer that was about delicious food. My grandmother made delicious food. She also beat me with a spoon. So we wanted to like project. So that there the Italian Pils was born, right? Italian
I kind of figured there was a background.
Like for us, I mean, we didn't create the Italian Pils, but our Italian Pils was born on that idea of like a food beer,
sure,
hoppy, delicious, made with 100% Arachalia malt grown in the Adriatic Sea, the banks of that area in Italy. And we do dry hop it with Spalt Select and Tappnanger hops, which give it a spicy, like herbal character. And we actually, that beer goes through like some ridiculous culinary things that you wouldn't do as a brewery, like that were actually created by some of these Italian brewers who actually, so the malt gives you a nice like sweet crackery kind of like sweetness, which is different from like German pils. We make the water a little harder to make it like that region. It helps accentuate the hops. We actually dry hop in primary fermentation while like we pitch yeast and hops at the same time, which is not a brewing technique like that is used a lot.
That's interesting, yeah.
So, and what we do is when we transfer the beer from the kettle, we save about 10 gallons of wort from the kettle.
Yeah.
And we freeze it.
Ooh.
And we transfer it in the lager tank. We add those big frozen blocks of sugary, sweet, you know, wort. And actual, in the transfer, we use a little bit of yeast, you know, in the transfer as well. And it re-ferments, actually, in the lager tank. It eats those sugars slowly and creates a lot of the carbonation in the beer. And that's a German, old world German technique called spieß. So spieß is actually you're taking original wort and you're reintroducing it back into the beer after its primary fermentation, which creates the carbonation in the final lagering phase of the beer, which gives you and it doesn't eat at all, so it leaves a little bit of extra sweetness in there, that malty kind of like malt ball character, a little bit of sweeter kind of malt that's in depth with the graininess. And it's just a character you can't get without doing that. You could do another thing called krausen. So if you have a lot of lager on your portfolio and you're making lager all the time, you don't really have to save a spieß and reintroduce it. You could just use wort from another batch, which is called krausen. You know,
interesting.
You're krausening a beer with future wort from another batch into a batch that you brewed, you know, typically about a little less than 3 weeks. And that's actually carbonating the beer. But we don't have lager on our program enough, so we just remove that, the spieß, freeze it, which is the way to keep it neutralized, bacteria-free. And
nice.
And then we just kind of thaw it out a little bit just to get it out of the bucket and get it back into our lager tank and transfer the beer on top of it. It really helps reduce DO, dissolved oxygen in beer, because that fermentation that happens needs a little bit of oxygen, so it eats that, and it creates a beautiful, clean beer, very low DO, and a little bit of tighter bubbles in it, because it's using the, you know, it's the bubbles can't escape, so it makes, rather than forced carbonation, it's natural carbonation, which is like, you know, the British call it real ale or whatever, and...
Nice.
It just...
what a process.
It's a technique that I don't think many... Like, I think krausen is used in the brewing industry a lot, but I think spieß is... I don't think there's another brewery in the East Coast. Maybe there is. I don't know. I'm a nerd reading books. I'm a German lover. I probably made more Pilsner, Saison, and, you know, IPA. Those are the three things I brewed the most while I was a home brewer. And those are the things that inspired me the most. And that's why I kind of nerded out on some of these techniques that I wanted to bring into my professional brewing from home brewing that seemed to work for me as a home brewer. So,
like walking the dog
at
New Salem, incredible beer.
Yeah, and that's...
That Pilsner is nuts. How often does that... How often do you brew that? Because doesn't that go quickly?
Well, I've heard it goes so very fast. So walking the dog can be a few different things, because it is a Pilsner, but it can be a German Pils, it can be a Czech Pils, it can be, you know, so the shape of the dog changes. Like it could be a wiener dog,
the hair of the dog.
German Shepherd, it could be many things. But so that's kind of a weird beer in the way that it's like you know how like certain breweries have like they have a rotating hop series?
Yeah.
Well, we have a rotating country series on our Pilsners.
I love
it. That's how that works.
That's awesome.
And I think it's just to use one label to do, because they're all the same alcohol. So the label still works. I think the picture of the dog changes. And maybe the word underneath, you know, the picture is, says Czech pills or German pills or.
Thank you so much for listening to part one of a two-part podcast episode with my dear friend and master of beer, John Watson. Stay tuned next week for part number two and a continuation from where we left off. Yet again, another episode of Sweeten Up is in the books. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. We would greatly appreciate your feedback and support. As a reminder, you can play the podcast with the help of your smart speaker by simply saying, play the podcast Sweeten Up with Jeff Spencer. Thank you as always to my best friends, the guys who make it all possible, post-production and music Morgan Lutzi, production and art director Kurt Vinci, editor and writer Nick Pasacreta, and a special thanks as always to Devin Cipelli. I will see you next week for part two of my two-part conversation with John Watson. And until then, you know the deal. Stay safe, stay healthy, love you all, peace.